Support for today's episode of Script Apart comes from We Screenplay. If you've just completed a draft of a script and are wondering what next, well, you need to check out We Screenplay. We Screenplay not only offers amazing free resources, like virtual events where your questions are answered by Hollywood's leading professionals, with incredible 72-hour turnaround, format-specific feedback tailored to your specific goals, and a price that no one else can come close to, We Screenplay coverage is used by thousands of writers in every phase of their careers, from emerging writers still finding their voice all the way to Oscar winners. So if your script is all ready to go, check out one of We Screenplay's labs, where dozens of writers have been repped, optioned, and staffed as a direct result of the real-life industry meetings and hands-on workshops offered by We Screenplay. Don't stay stuck. We Screenplay want to help. Check out We Screenplay by visiting wescreenplay.com or clicking the link in today's show notes. Support for this episode also comes from our friends at Arc Studio Pro. Arc Studio is the screenwriting software used to create incredible shows and movies, such as the acclaimed Netflix animation Arcane. It has a ton of features designed to unlock your creativity on the page, whether you're a seasoned industry professional or a first-time writer discovering your voice. Arc is all about minimum distraction and maximum ease of collaboration. There's an outlining whiteboard for mapping out your story, automatic draft management for keeping those scripts safe, and it also offers real-time collaboration similar to Google Docs, making it the easiest way to run a professional writer's room or just to write that great idea for a script that you have with a friend. Try it today. Head to arcstudiopro.com/scriptapart, where you can get $30 off a pro account by using the code FRIENDS at checkout. Click the link in today's show notes to take your screenwriting to the next level. Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of Script Apart, a podcast about the first draft secrets of great movies and TV shows. I'm Al Horner, and unlike Margot Robbie's character in the astonishingly hedonistic epic that we're covering this week on the show, I have sadly never fought a rattlesnake. I have, however, had the pleasure of chatting with Damien Chazelle, one of my favourite filmmakers of the last decade. The Whiplash auteur's latest drama, Babylon, is a fevered telling of how 1920s Hollywood reacted as the industry transitioned from silent film to sound, shining a spotlight on the drug-riddled dreamers chewed up and spat out by Tinseltown as it underwent that seismic change. It's a story that truly puts the sin in Singing in the Rain, if you'll excuse the bad joke, following an ensemble of characters as they experience both the divinity and the destruction of the American movie-making machine. It really is an experience unlike anything I've had in the cinema in quite some time, with Margot Robbie astonishing as the doomed Nellie LeRoy, a character loosely based on real-life actress Clara Bow. If all that sounds drastically unlike Damien's previous work, well, that's intentional. The La La Land filmmaker wanted to make a movie at the other end of the storytelling spectrum to that acclaimed 2016 musical. When I spoke to him for a feature for Empire magazine before the movie's release, he told me that if La La Land was a love letter to Hollywood, then Babylon is written with a poison pen. Having now seen the film, I'd say that pretty much checks out. Catching up for a spoiler breakdown of the movie and its incredible screenplay, we spoke about how early iterations of the film centered on Brad Pitt's character Jack. We get into the eye-opening real-life stories of 1920s Hollywood debauchery that Damien pulled from, and of course, we break down in detail that incredible sensory ending that I don't think anyone saw coming, a sequence in which a character called Manny sits in a cinema and seemingly manages to see through time into the future of movie making. I had the best time with Damien, this was a really fun one to record, and I hope you guys enjoy this conversation. One quick thing to mention before we dive in, Script Apart is on Patreon. If you like what we do and want to see the show continue to grow, you can now support us for the price of a single monthly cup of coffee. In exchange, you'll get ad-free episodes, early access to episodes, the chance to ask your questions to future guests, and now also access to an exclusive bonus segment of the show called Postscript, in which each week after an episode drops, my producer Cam and I have a really fun, really casual video hang, discussing our big takeaways from that episode and going a bit more in depth into our relationship with that filmmaker's work. It's a lot of fun. Head to patreon.com/scriptapart if you'd like to get involved there. We really do appreciate your support. Okay, with that all out the way, let's get into it, shall we? This is the incredible Damien Chazelle discussing the first draft secrets of Babylon. Thank you guys so much for tuning in. You're listening to Script Apart, hosted by me, Al Horner, produced by Camille Demec. Hey Damien, thank you so much for joining us on Script Apart today. Congrats on Babylon, first and foremost. I love this film. I'm a paid-up member of the Babylon Hive, as I think the internet has called it. I'm excited to get a chance to chat about it with you. I guess I wanted to begin by just checking in to see what it's like being on the other side of a project like this. You know, I know from our previous conversation that you worked for over a decade to get it out of your imagination and onto the screen. Is the overriding feeling right now one of satisfaction with everything you were able to achieve in telling this story? Is there a bittersweet element at all? Kind of having to, I suppose, like let go of these characters who've been residing in your head for so long. Yeah, take me through it. Where are you at right now emotionally with Babylon, having gone on such a journey to bring it to life?
It's a funny time because I guess I've just started to have enough space to try to think about something that's, you know, think about whether it's the next project or whatever, but just something that's not Babylon. So it's actually kind of it's like I can breathe again after what felt like in retrospect, it does feel like a decade of holding my breath in some way. But of course, it wasn't really that. I guess the sort of process of making this was much more sort of off and on than that. But it does feel like it's been this kind of sustained bout of, you know, fighting this this beast of a movie. Kind of, it felt like trying to tame a sort of borderline untamable wild beast of some kind, and whether I succeeded or not, it's nice to kind of at least be moving on from that. You know, it's sort of that chapter is kind of drawing to a close ish in terms of where my head's at right now. So when you mentioned the bittersweet thing of letting characters go and whatnot, I don't know. To me, it's just sweet to let them go. of course, you can be nostalgic for the process of, there were some wonderful moments making this movie. You can be nostalgic for that. But I think when you've been sort of wrestling with something for so long, it's really just, you've been waiting for the moment to finally relinquish it. And it feels like finally that moment is here.
So now that you do have a bit of distance from the film, have you come to any new conclusions at all about why you hung on to this story and your dream of telling it for so long, Damien? Obviously, like I understand there was a technical challenge to making a film of this scale, something bigger than anything you'd tackled before. I also, you know, of course, understand that you're hugely passionate about Hollywood history and we're attracted to the idea of Babylon almost like a small piece of where we've come from as a film culture that could add new perspective to where we are today. That was appealing. But have you come to any new realizations post-release about what it was about Babylon that you couldn't let go on a personal level or on a story level? Are there things you realize now spoke to you emotionally about these characters? Or was it mostly the technical challenge and the opportunity to delve into a lesser known part of American cultural history that was the main draw, do you think?
Yeah, I guess it was a combo because it was, it certainly started off, I think, as just something that kind of came out of historical curiosity. I had recently moved to LA, spending most of my life on the East Coast of the States, and sort of settling in this weird new city, Los Angeles, that I kind of couldn't really wrap my mind around. And there was something about the weirdness of it and the feeling of isolation in Los Angeles and the sort of trying to kind of place what sort of a city it was. I mean, eventually you kind of learn with LA that it's really not like any other city. And you either embrace that and you fall in love with it, or you keep wanting it to be a normal city, and then you're going to hate it. That's sort of where I've come to with it. But I think that to try to understand or unpack what makes LA LA, you know, it is sort of inextricable from its history, and it's a very weird history. It's a weirdly short history compared to most other cities. It's also a history that was marked by very fast upheaval and fast changes. I think of LA as almost like a city that did pack in, you know, maybe many centuries worth of history, but just into the span of like 150 years. So it's like this fast forward crash course kind of history, not that dissimilar from the history of the movie so far. It's also, you know, which we're also talking about a young art form. We're talking about a art form that I think is still figuring itself out in many ways. But of course, you know, you sort of think back to the origins of the movies, and it feels like you might as well be talking about the ancient past, because the record is so spotty, and there's a sort of mythology that's grown up around it. So I think I just sort of became interested in LA history. I was already interested in movie history, and just maybe trying to kind of untangle why LA is the way it is, why it's this sprawling sort of non-city city, where, you know, where the movies have had this kind of symbiotic relationship with the city for, again, now the better part of, 100 plus years. Certainly LA was not just born by the movies, but the growth of the movies definitely helped fuel the growth of LA. And that sort of, I guess, you know, long story short, led me to the period of time that this movie's about, where you really felt those two engines really feeding off each other. LA as a metropolitan area just mushrooming in this just sort of insane way, movies, you know, going from, you know, in the span of those 10 years of the 20s, let's say that they go from, you know, 1920, we've just started to get used to the idea of feature films, so it's really brand new. You know, Birth of a Nation is 15, Intolerance is 1916. You know, so it's really sort of this new concept. And and from 1920 to the time that sound comes in, it somehow becomes this ubiquitous pop cultural just sort of phenomenon that starts to make so much money that the rest of society, even though they want to treat the movies as vulgar, they want to treat them as sort of pornographic or kind of somewhere below vaudeville, they sort of eventually realize they can't. They sort of have to grapple with it. And so it's that twin thing of a city growing too fast, an industry and an art form growing too fast. And eventually the powers that be, you know, they can't let that kind of growth go unregulated. They have to sort of step in and control things a little bit. And to me, that's how you wind up with the Hollywood today, which really was a product of the late 20s and early 30s, the Hollywood of sync sound, the Hollywood of, you know, regulations, the Hollywood of the Hays Code, which begins in the 30s, you know. So, I guess I go back to the thing that I continually find interesting about LA is the joke of LA that it doesn't have history. The reality is sort of that it's got, I think, a ton of these kind of really fast-paced historical changes, but just they're just sandwiched into the span of 10 years, you know. So you can actually, it's amazing, you can actually look at a city and a society changing dramatically. To tell that story with most societies, you would have to tell it over 100 years. With LA, you can do it in 10, you can do it even in 6, let's say, which is sort of roughly what this movie does. And in that span of time, you can see giant parts of the city just go from total desert or just rural dirt roads and, you know, freshly planted palm trees to congested urban thoroughfares filled with traffic and smog, you know, and you can see this sort of movie, you know, this thing called movies go from the sort of newfangled vulgar art form that's shooting silently to, you know, the sort of Broadway adjacent sync sound kind of totally regulated, unionized, moral coded sort of industry that we now call Hollywood. You know, and so it's a big story. It's sort of a, you know, kind of upheaval of a society story, but somehow LA, the uniqueness of LA and the uniqueness of movie history allows you to sort of look at it in a short frame of time.
Yeah, the film does such a good job at capturing the turbulence of that accelerated change. Damien, the last time I had the pleasure of speaking with you, we talked about how your movies kind of frequently shine a spotlight on dreamers, these characters who long to achieve the impossible. And through the course of your movies, we see the blood, the sweat, the tears demanded of them to do that, whether that character's dream is to kind of become a jazz great or to walk on the moon. It's at that point when we spoke, I hadn't seen Babylon. And now that I've seen it, like, well, God, 3 or 4 times, it feels like there's a definite continuation of that element of your storytelling here. But this time, kind of with a sting in the tail. Like, unlike your previous movies, there's a cost and a corrosion to making this particular dream a reality for these characters. And it's one that isn't really overcome. I'd love to know, Was that always the arc? Like, even in the earliest incarnations of this story going back a decade? And if so, what was it that demanded you encompass both sides of the movie-making machine, like the magic and the malevolence?
I think maybe the malevolence was sort of even more the point of departure, I guess, on this one. I think the thing that maybe first started to get me thinking that there could be a movie to be made, or another movie to be made, let's say, about the transition from silent to sound, or set during that time, you know, having seen Singing in the Rain, having seen that sort of treatment of that story, which is so brilliant and perfect and sort of untouchable, you know, learning that beyond, let's say, just people having to kind of, you know, adapt their styles of acting, or beyond, you know, certain careers going up and down, the turbulence that you referenced, the sort of accelerated change that was going on, that was having to do with sound, but also was sort of having to do with other things happening either concurrently or that were sort of byproducts of the sound revolution. There was such a violence to those changes that actually resulted in things like, so you can actually look at, you know, sort of, and some of it becomes a little apocryphal, but it is true that you a lot of people killed themselves in this period of time. And then there's a lot of those deaths where, you know, it's sort of the question mark, drug overdoses and whatnot, where, you know, are they deaths of despair or are they accidental? But it suddenly occurred to me that, you know, it's like you had this sort of, you have this massive change, technological change, out of which a whole new host of stars emerge. But you've got all these sort of corpses sort of lining the way. And of course, Hollywood is very good at, you know, manicuring its history and sweeping those corpses under the rug, and let's not pay too much attention to that kind of stuff. So I don't know. I guess I used to have this idea that it was just sort of all, let's say, more peaceful, that it was like a peaceful transfer of power, you know, which of course is never really the case, right? It's like people with power don't give it up willingly, usually. So there's always violence, either figurative or literal, associated with it. So I just became interested in that, I think, that moment in Hollywood history was a really dark, sordid, you know, for many people, deadly one, full of despair, full of desperation. I guess it's, you know, I also, I guess, find it interesting how, if you look at movies about Hollywood, you know, that they tend to fall into one of two camps. It's you either have the love letter, you know, the sort of fairy tale, or you have the, you know, Hollywood is a nightmare cesspool and get out while you can. And there was something about this era, maybe more than any other in Hollywood history, where it did feel like those two opposite poles were not just coexistent, but almost needed each other, you know, because silent cinema is, to me, the most sublime that cinema can be. It's the most divine. It's the most angelic. It's the most, you'll never have a greater feeling if looking at a film of, you know, that this wasn't even made by humans. This was, you know, these are images touched by God. You know, there's something that approaches religious iconography, you know, about a close up of, you know, Greta Garbo or Louise Brooks or Valentino or something. And actually, you know, by extension, people of the time often reacted to these close ups as though they were religious iconography. There was an hysteria to the fandom. So there was just this sort of peak of passion there, that you could think of as like the dreamiest Hollywood, the Hollywood dream gets, you know. So then, but then if you coincide that with unprecedented rash of, you know, just careers wrecked from one day to the next, and suicides, and you got the Great Depression coming in, you've got LA just, you know, transforming even faster than it had before as a city. I mean, you just have this sort of wrecking ball coming in and destroying everything that people have kind of gotten used to. You've got the two sides of the coin right there in front of you, even within the same frame, you know. So I guess that sort of became, yeah, maybe like emotionally, tonally became the compass for me. Sort of that was the point of doing the movie, in a way, was to try to get at that duality, I guess.
So that duality was baked in from the very beginning. One thing that, from the sounds of it, was a bit more up in the air in these early stages of developing the film was the ensemble nature of the movie. Like, I understand that your earliest outline was a bit more straightforward, and it had a sole protagonist. So Jack Conrad, Brad Pitt's character, he was really the focus of the film from the sounds of things. Can you tell me about that evolution? You know, moving from a movie telling Jack's story into this bigger tapestry full of all these fascinating characters, each kind of, you know, encountering and interacting with each other. I'd also be really curious, Damien, to know whether Jack was always an amalgamation of different real life inspirations, you know, because, well, I guess the elephant in the room here is the main inspiration for the character in the finished film seems to be the actor John Gilbert, but John Gilbert didn't take his own life in real life. And yeah, it seems the finished film, by the time you'd settled on the script, you were pulling from multiple points of inspiration in terms of that character and some of the others.
I feel like it was always or almost always an ensemble in my mind. But I think what happened was Jack was the first character who kind of materialized for me. I mean, you know, in some ways that makes sense. He's sort of there's two characters in this movie basically who are you know, let's say very very much archetypes or playing variations on, in their case they're playing on variations on characters that Singin' in the Rain directly treats, right? So Margot Robbie playing Nellie LeRoy, that's very much Lena Lamont played by Jean Hagen in Singin' in the Rain, who herself is, you know, has a little bit of Clara Bow and other people as references. And then Brad's character, Jack Conrad, is very much John Gilbert, who became Don Lockwood, played by Gene Kelly in Singin' in the Rain. So I think, you know, it makes sense that in some ways, you know, if I wanted to do this sort of riff, this kind of darker riff on the same subject matter that Singin' in the Rain treats, that those would be sort of two poles that would kind of present themselves early on to me. But going back to the suicide thing, I think there was a couple of things just sort of stood out right away to me that kind of you know, that just said, oh, this character would be, this could be interesting, that this should be at least a character, if not the lead character in the film. One was you know, it's like random stuff too, you know. So one was there's John Gilbert, yes, but John Gilbert also acted alongside an actor named Carl Dane, who's a little less known, who was also, you know, had some success, not John Gilbert level success, but some success during the silent era, and really hit the skids when sound came in. And, you know, John Gilbert wound up dying, you know, of alcohol related complications. Carl Dane, more like Brad Pitt's character in the movie, put a gun to his head. And there, you know, there's something about, I don't know, it's hard to put a finger on it, but something about, you know, you watch someone like Carl Dane, who actually had a little bit of a sort of almost jolly go lucky kind of demeanor on screen, you know, and you know, or any of these actors who met really sort of, let's say, grislier ends, and you're just trying to, you know, all you have, because there wasn't social media, there weren't interviews, you know, galore, there were some, but it was all very, you know, spotty. There weren't cameras following people to their homes. So all you really wind up having in the record is just the images of them in the films and maybe some glamour shots, you know, publicity stills, and then whatever sort of details you've learned about their life. And so there's this real, you know, kind of unreconcilable, you know, thing going on where you're just trying to sort of go, okay, is that really, is, wow, so that guy, okay, so that guy's career, you know, started to kind of dwindle, and but he was desperate enough to sort of pretty quickly go to the most extreme solution, let's say. Is that something to do with Hollywood and Hollywood at that time, maybe? Again, the same way that fans, you know, it was famously reported that a bunch of, you know, female fans around the country killed themselves when Valentino died. You know, this sort of pitch of insanity and hysteria, maybe because movies were new, maybe because the whole idea of a movie star was new. Therefore, the idea of the decline of a movie star was new and all this stuff. But anyway, Carl Dane sort of spoke to me right away. I always loved also the idea of doing something like, you know, there's the J.D. Salinger story, Perfect Day for Banana Fish, which famously ends with you know, a guy going into his hotel room and shooting himself. And the power of the story is, you know, is that there's this, again, this disconnect between the surface and what you kind of feel like is going on with the guy during the sort of majority of the story. And then the act he winds up committing very matter-of-factly at the end, which then kind of prompts you to sort of reread. And of course, on a reread, you sort of realize all the seeds were there. But I think that Carl Dane. And finally, there was there were these images, even before I saw the movie, there were these images of one of the lead actors in Raul Ruiz's Remembrance of Things Past, or his adaptation of the Proust novel, where the actor is sort of, you know, kind of in that case, sort of in a tuxedo and tails, and he's sort of walking around these sort of verandas. And I looked at those images and it just felt like, oh, this would be interesting to have someone who's like the epitome of a gentleman, who just moves with such grace through every room, every kind of avenue, to such an extent that he's sort of out of time, that he feels kind of separate from the people around him. And I guess I just love that idea of someone who finds themselves out of time, who finds themselves kind of still walking the walk that no longer exists, you know, and that there's almost this sort of grace and gallantry and beauty to it. There's a tragedy to it, but there's a beauty to it of like going down with your own ship, or the generals in World War I who just decided to stay on their horses and just go, even though war had become mechanized by that point and they were no match. You know, it's like the end of cavalry, the end of, I don't know, the sinking of the Titanic. It's like you go to all these things where you sort of think of like end of a way of life. And I don't know what's poetic about the sinking of the Titanic. To me, it's the people who sat with their brandy and sort of, you know, as the ship went down, or it's the violin, you know, the band playing as the ship went down. It's that idea. So I guess it's a long way of saying all of it started with the death. It started with the end of this character of, you know, whether it's Carl Dane or these images, you know, I was looking at, or the idea of someone out of time, or, you know, generals in World War One, or people on board the Titanic, or whatever it is, it all kind of started. The genesis was, you know, the sort of graceful exiting from the stage, I guess. And can that ever be graceful, right? I mean, that's the other thing too, of like, you know, at the end of the day, putting a gun to your head and blood splattering the wall, there's only so much grace that can be, you know, that can be embodied in that. But so the whole shot of Brad sort of going up the stairs and kind of, you know, kind of waltzing to the music a little bit and going into his room, the camera staying outside the door and all that stuff, that was the first shot in my head. That was there before there was any script or any real story, even really. That was kind of, I would say, if there was one concrete thing that was the genesis for all of it, it was that. That said, I do think early on, I kind of knew that it wouldn't just be his story. I do think I had a sense, if I'm remembering correctly, that needed to be one of several stories. I couldn't just do the John Gilbert story, essentially, or even the Carl Dane story. That you know, we've kind of we've seen that before in some way. So that would be interesting as a counterpoint and as a sort of in dialogue with other stories, but not so much maybe as the sole story, if that makes sense.
Hey, this is Al, just jumping in to tell you about two of our great sponsors this week. Breaking into Hollywood as an aspiring writer can be a confusing, convoluted thing. Fortunately, ScreenCraft is here to help writers with both the craft of writing and the business of Hollywood. ScreenCraft has everything for your writing journey, from video lectures starring your favorite writers to hands-on career coaching with their excellent writer development team. These guys offer the best screenwriting competitions designed to help your talent shine, featuring judges that really know their genre, from top literary reps to Oscar-winning screenwriters. Hundreds of past winners and finalists have started their careers with the direct support of ScreenCraft. Winners have been staffed on shows at Netflix, Amazon, Apple TV+, the list goes on. They've also sold scripts and been hired to write films for the likes of Universal, Lionsgate, Blumhouse, and Hulu. So if you're an aspiring writer, what are you waiting for? Don't wait to check out ScreenCraft today. Visit screencraft.org or click the link in today's show notes. Support for this episode also comes from Arc Studio Pro. Screenwriting to me is all about immersion. I want to stay immersed in that dreamy, fantasy-like state while I weave my story and craft my characters. I don't want to be distracted by anything, and I certainly don't want to be thinking about text formatting. Arc Studio Pro understands that. It's so intuitive, it has a minimal and, dare I say, beautiful interface that allows me to stay completely focused on the story I'm trying to tell. To take your screenwriting to the next level, visit arcstudiopro.com/scriptapart, where you can either download a free version or get $30 off a pro account to unlock its full host of amazing features. Use the code FRIENDS at checkout to get that discount. That's arcstudiopro.com scriptapart. Okay, let's get back to the conversation. I mean, my knowledge of this whole era is pretty limited to the Kenneth Anger book and some other kind of bits of research. But I'm aware just from that that there's such a sprawl, like an infinite pool of, stories to pull from. As you were kind of assembling this story and writing that first draft, were there things that you tried to include, but there wasn't ultimately space for? Like, what were some of the kind of avenues you went down while kind of, and you know, trying to piece this story together that ultimately didn't wind up in Babylon?
Maybe around the same time or shortly after, kind of landing on some version of Jack's character, I thought that maybe our eyes into the world are kind of our guide through it would be a title card writer, which obviously sort of went by the wayside, though Li Junli's character, Lady Feijiu, part-times as a title card writer. But, you know, I guess I became really interested in specifically the art of title card writing and this sort of lost art form of kind of the sort of concise, it was a kind of poetry, it was a kind of haiku sort of poetry that they had to really... perfect in the silent era, that you would think a lot of those people who perfected it then went on to be successful screenwriters or whatnot, but not necessarily. It was really sort of a different, it was again kind of a different skill set, even more so than one might think, similar to, you know, silent acting versus sound acting. Anyway, I think I thought that would be sort of our way in. I wound up kind of feeling like I didn't have enough, I don't know, I just didn't feel like there was enough, maybe enough there. You know, one of Hitchcock's earliest jobs, for instance, was writing title cards, you know. And does a title card writer wind up kind of rising up the ranks in other ways, behind the camera, whatnot? Anyway, eventually that became Manny, Diego Calva's character, of just, you know, of course, turned into something totally different. But the idea of someone who would be always behind the camera, not a star or wannabe star, but someone who just wants to be, part of the enterprise, you know, that he would be sort of our guy. I think initially I also sort of thought of him as very much a kind of innocent in Terra Incognita, that he would just be, and that maybe he would also help structure the thing, that it would be a little bit of a picaresque, that it'd be sort of, so it's a little bit of Barry Lyndon or a little bit of Candide. I think for a while I was just calling him Candide because I couldn't think of a name. So, you know, it was just very much this idea of the perennial innocent, the perennial boy, basically, who just sort of takes us into the opposite of an innocent land, let's say. You could say some vestige of that remained, but then pretty quickly, I think I also, you know, became interested in the idea of how the innocent can be corrupted, and, you know, the idea of how maybe he starts making moral decisions that come back to haunt him and whatnot. So, you know, but yeah, I think part of what made it also scattershot and haphazard, and, you know, that, you know, this character moves from this to that, and this changes and this and that, it was just that I wasn't like working on it in one sort of sustained bout at any given time. It was something where I would sort of do some work on it, some thinking on it, and then I'd go make a movie or something, or do something else and forget about it, and then I'd return to it. And in the meantime, the research would just sort of pile up, and I would just read stuff. And eventually, once I actually felt like, okay, I actually need to start taking this more seriously, then I just kind of started plowing through all the sort of books and binders and documents that had sort of piled up on the shelves, and just kind of, I would just highlight everything that felt interesting to me. So everything in like any Kevin Brownlow book that seemed of interest, or anything in Kenneth Anger, anything in any of the biographies of people, you know, I'd read biographies of Claire Beau or Anna Mae Wong or John Gilbert, also just different communities that I started to be interested in. I became really interested in African-American sort of cinema right at the dawn of sound, and how the sort of Hollywood tried to kind of co-opt the sort of idea of the jazz film, and how it's kind of a way of looking at the birth of the musical. And so looking at that, looking at Mexican Americans in Los Angeles and sort of influx during the Mexican Revolution, and Chinatown in LA is another really fascinating thing. The old Chinatown, you know, Chinatown in LA today is not at all what Chinatown was. Chinatown in the 20s was this, you know, it's kind of amazing looking at pictures of it because none of it exists anymore. It was 100% closed over, you know. And that's where Anna May Wong lived, you know. And so I kind of, everything I found interesting, I would sort of highlight or write down, and I just sort of compiled them into this like big, yeah, just hundreds of pages of just sort of notes that I sort of compiled. And that became my Bible, essentially, for then writing the script. You know, that became the thing that then I needed to take a machete to and sort of carve down sort of make some shape out of it. But I'd say every script can probably be found somewhere in that, you know, in that 100 or whatever it was, 200 page sort of collection of notes that I compiled. I'd say you probably can trace everything to that.
Yeah, there's something you said there about the fragmented way that you were chipping away at this movie, kind of in chunks between work on other films. That makes a lot of sense to me because Babylon does feel like a story told in vignettes. There's the party scene at the beginning. There's the scene of all the simultaneous productions kind of happening side by side in the desert that culminates in Manny racing against impending dusk in a stolen ambulance to get that golden hour shot. There's also the Hello College scene. All of these have these kind of really beautiful crescendos within themselves. They have a beginning, a middle, and an end. They have a payoff. And they don't feel quite like just connective tissue to get us to the next scene. Speaking of scenes, we should really dive into a few choice ones. And I'd love to hear how they came together on the page. This is a scene in which Margot's character, Nellie, she goes to see her mother in some sort of medical facility. The first time I watched the film, I think I missed how vital that entire sequence is. And how great a skeleton key it is, you know, into understanding why Nellie lives like there's no tomorrow. Because, you know, well, there is no tomorrow in her eyes. You know, that's what tomorrow looks like. There's something depressing to her about the parental figures in her life that seems to fuel the way that she lives for today. I love that scene. It doesn't necessarily push the story forward, but it has a real quiet importance to Babylon, I think. Can you talk to me about Nellie, like who that character was, Damien, and why that moment of vulnerability was really important to include?
Yeah, that scene is pulled pretty much, beat for beat from an incident in Clara Bow's life. And I'm blanking on who the Manny in the scene was. It was a friend of Clara Bow's or some sort of companion of Clara Bow's who, very much like Manny in that scene, found themselves, to their surprise, in a sanatorium with Clara Bow and this woman, you know, just who wasn't introduced and wouldn't say a word, just coming up to Clara Bow, and Clara Bow saying a few things and this sort of awkward exchange, and then they left, and that was it. And it was only sort of through kind of the spare interaction and then what Clara said afterwards that the friend was even able to deduce that was her mother. The little glimpse, I guess, of a past that just, you know, that otherwise Clara, or in this case Nellie, wants absolutely nothing, you know, nothing to do with. But you're right about, you know, also the fact that it's not necessarily a plot scene, which is, you know, when I was cutting, when I was working on the edit of the movie with my editor, Tom Cross, you know, I mean, we knew we had a long movie in our hands. The script was long, and we were trying to be pretty relentless and ruthless on only sort of using what we absolutely needed. So I remember our first cut actually didn't have that scene. It had didn't have the sanatorium. It didn't have the sort of talk between Nellie and Manny afterwards in the car. Yeah, and we've decided, you know, afterwards that was a mistake. But I guess it sort of speaks a little bit to what you're saying of, you know, sometimes there are those moments that it's not necessarily immediately obvious what they're sort of doing structurally or what, you know, what kind of parts of the edifice they're supporting. And you only sometimes really realize what those scenes are doing once you take them out. And so that's kind of what happened to us with that scene. It's a little less obvious what it's doing, I guess, than some of the others.
One of the other scenes that I really feel the desire to ask you about is the Tobey Maguire scene. It's pretty hilarious that Toby was erroneously reported for a long time to be playing Charlie Chaplin in Babylon. His character, of course, in this movie couldn't really be further from Chaplin. Instead, he plays this kind of Gollum-esque creature who guides Manny through a through a kind of Dantean subterranean Hollywood party. The whole scene feels like a literal descent into Hollywood's ugly id. One thing that occurred to me as I was in the cinema watching that, you know, and being led through all that depravity, all that horror as this kind of natural endpoint for the hedonism that's been building all the way through the film. One thing that kind of crossed my mind, a question, was what level of pushback you had, if any, against the depravity in this film? Like, was there anything in your original script, either in this scene or elsewhere in the film, that you ended up taking out because it felt like it crossed a line or was maybe kind of a bit gratuitous or maybe it made things difficult in terms of classification, anything like that? Talk me through it, Damien.
No, there wasn't anything specific that all the kind of specific gags that were sort of, written or shot wound up in the movie. It's more the sort of background stuff where you realize as you're cutting it, as you're living with it, you know, that there's only so many, after a certain point, a certain number of penises or breasts or whatnot, it just sort of like starts to become diminishing returns, you know? And so it became a little more that sort of calibration where it's like, we knew the kind of anchor points where, and those were more, I guess, what I would call the sort of specific gags where that, you know, they have their own shot or they have their own sort of, you know, moment. And those were all in the script. And so those were kind of, sort of anchor points for us. And then when it came to just sort of the stuff you're seeing generally, or the stuff that the camera might be kind of, you know, panning to or whatnot in between those anchor points, you know, that's where we would try, you know, we would try slimming stuff down and then feel like actually we weren't, it wasn't dirty enough. And then we'd sort of ramp it back up and feel like we'd overdone it. And, you know, it becomes so subjective, right? I mean, it's like, I'm sure there's many people, if not most people, who probably still feel that that there's too much of all of that kind of stuff. But I think there was the calculated decision, I guess, on erring on the side of too much rather than too little. It was, again, a little bit the point of the movie, you know, I guess, again, borrowing a page from the anger book, that Hollywood is a self manicuring kind of place. And I think you really feel that in a lot of old Hollywood, sort of depictions and stuff. You just feel this sort of, it's like everyone is always, you know, perfectly coiffed and perfumed and pencil eyebrowed and all this stuff. And it's just that wasn't the reality of Hollywood in the 20s. It was sweaty and dirty and filthy, and people had yellow teeth and dirt under their fingernails and were, to borrow the literal words from one of the actresses at the time, fucking like rabbits, and we're on drugs 24/7. So it felt to me like it's silly that we don't really know that, you know, that's not sort of that we have this idea of the quote roaring 20s as still a relatively tame place compared to eras of debauchery that we sort of have more vividly stuck in our head. Let's say, you know, the 70s or 80s, you know, sort of punk scene, or 60s, you know, the sexual revolution or whatnot, you know, whereas I would argue that the 20s were basically as, you know, transgressive and debaucherous and insane as you get, in many ways, unprecedented, unrepeated. I think it has something to do with where they were coming from, you know, that's something about the psyche when you've just gone through World War One and the Spanish flu and sort of kind of the end of Victorianism and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I think people were ready to go completely crazy. So I think we knew that we needed to err on the side of really shoving that into the audience's face rather than going subtle. This was not, subtlety was not the order of the day on this movie.
Well, yeah, it's a 3-hour film and I could spend 3 days talking about every scene in detail, but we are against the clock, Damien. So before I leave you, I'm going to ask about one final scene, and it of course is the ending. I can't get away without asking about this incredible, overwhelming, very sensory final sequence. It struck me on second watch that it's such a beautiful callback to the scene in which Jean Smart's character Eleanor is describing to Jack what it means to be a movie star. They have this incredible exchange where she talks about the transaction taking place, the kind of bargain you're entering into when you agree to stardom, stardom will corrode you and it will spit you out. But as Eleanor says, one day every person on every film shot this year will be dead. And one day all those films will be pulled from the vaults and all their ghosts will dine together and go on adventures together, go to the jungle, to war together. Your time today is through, but you'll spend eternity with angels and ghosts. The way that Manny in this final scene seems to kind of almost reach through time in his seat watching the montage, you know, spanning the entirety of movie history right up to this day, you know, I think it speaks to that. It speaks to what Eleanor is saying there. And, you know, it shows that cinema can be a form of revival. It can be a form of time travel. Or at least this was my reading of it. Feel free to correct me. But yeah, Damien, what does this ending mean to you? How did it come about? I understand that there must have been some big change, some big evolution somewhere late on, because this ending is not in the script. The ending in the script is a lot more conventional. Take me through it.
Yeah, on the page, it's just sort of describing Manny sitting there watching Singing in the Rain and that prompting a sort of host of emotions, both sort of good and bad. And as an ending, that was pretty, you know, I remember that was relatively early in the process, you know, again, before there was really a script that I sort of knew, you know, that I kind of decided that it would end in some version of that, that we would sort of explicitly acknowledge the movie that this movie is sort of in kind of covert dialogue with, or not so covert dialogue with, the entire time, Singing in the Rain. And I sort of liked the idea, I guess, of yeah, the movie sort of revealing itself as a kind of almost a sort of weird making of Singing in the Rain, like origin story for Singing in the Rain. We sort of filmed exactly that. And then, yeah, it just wasn't quite doing it. It was sort of like the movie was ending with a whimper when it needed to end with a bang. And it was actually sort of going back to the script that helped, I think, point the way to what to do, because the script was certainly, the script did not, you know, reference Manny watching Avatar or something, but it used a lot of description. It wound up ending with let's say 2 pages of just description that was, you know, kind of purple prose, but, you know, very sort of like throwing around lots of adjectives that ultimately, I guess, gave you, the reader, a sort of what felt like a complete emotional journey. And so it was that idea of trying to capture the feeling that the script seemed to sort of gesture at the end. That was a bigger, more encompassing feeling than what we had just filmed. And sort of realizing that actually the only way to do that was to not just literally film the bare bones actions that the script was indicating, but to go a little bit, sort of get at it a little bit indirectly and to sort of try things. And so it wound up being a matter of really trying things and throwing things at the wall and seeing what stuck. And that's kind of how it wound up, but sort of always with the script being the basic compass. So I guess, again, maybe that's sort of the irony of it, that in some ways, yeah, the ending was this total sort of creation of post-production and sort of, you know, late in the game, 11th hour sort of thing of let's shake things up and try something totally different. But, you know, looking back, I think really what it ultimately was, you know what, we realized that we didn't actually successfully film the script, and we got to figure out a way to actually do what the script does. And of course, it speaks to the difference between the two mediums and the written word and the filmed, you know, image, that that we had to sort of, I think, had to do something as sort of, you know, out there or kind of silly, or, you know, whatever you call it, that the movie needed to get a little spastic in the way it does in the beginning. It needed to get a little bit absurdist and manic and a little drug fueled and you know, a little goofy but also a little you know, gesturing at something that I do think is a sort of deeper idea of we've just sort of seen 3 hours of kind of, you know, what a given technological change does to the people on the ground. And so this montage is basically one technological change after another, you know, and then you hopefully sort of wind up wondering, well, did all of those cause as much damage as we just saw, you know? And so on the one hand, you're seeing a kind of greatest hits compilation. On the other hand, you're seeing one cemetery after the next. You're seeing one, you know, war after the next. You're seeing more and more corpses littered on the ground that Hollywood has kind of tucked underneath. And so I guess I think of it a little bit in that way of you know, both, again, like the whole movie, I guess, both a celebration and a condemnation of this weird thing we call Hollywood, or, well, you know, let's just say that we call cinema, because I guess it's not just Hollywood.
That's a beautiful place to leave it, Damien. Thank you so much. You mentioned at the top of this, you know, starting to get into that headspace of what comes next. Whatever that is, I'm so excited, man. Congratulations on everything you've achieved with this. And yeah, hope to speak soon.
Thank you. This was so fun.
You've been listening to Script Apart, hosted by me, Al Horner, produced by Camille Demek. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next time.